Morning, Council. How much time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
All right. Proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Swift here on behalf of Christopher Irvin. Mr. Irvin is asking this court to reverse his two convictions for assault and malicious mischief for two alternative reasons. The first is that the trial court deprived him of his right to present a defense for denying his request for the voluntary intoxication instruction. And that, of course, requires this court to look at all the evidence and reasonable inferences therefrom in Mr. Irvin's favor. And the second is that in the event this court determines there was not substantial evidence of his intoxication, then defense counsel was ineffective, basically, for failing to establish a sufficient factual basis for the instruction. And that argument is based on, basically, the evidence we have from the 3-5 hearing where Deputy Hancock testified he believed Irvin was very intoxicated during this event, and Irvin himself testified he had done several drugs that day and drank as well. So going to the first issue, the defense has the right to have the jury instructed on a defense supported by substantial evidence. With voluntary intoxication, that requires basically three elements. The first is that the charged crime includes a mental state. Assault requires intent, and malicious mischief, in this case, requires knowingly and maliciously damaging an emergency vehicle. The state has argued that issue is waived with regard to malicious mischief, but maliciously was defined for the jury as evil intent, and so that encompasses intent. The jury was also instructed that when you act intentionally, you also act with knowledge.
So when he repeatedly kicked at the window, that was involuntary? It wasn't with intent?
Well, that would be a jury question, whether he acted with intent. And the point is that in this case, there needs to be substantial evidence of his intoxication, that it impacted his mental state. And of course, there's basically from the beginning of this case, when we have a 911 caller calling in saying, hey, there's this really drunk guy, he's running out in traffic, he's throwing cans at cars, he's acting very erratically. The cops show up, watch him for a minute, he's yelling profanities at cars, he's hiding in doorways and darting out of cars.
Yeah, but if he's hiding in the doorway, waiting for the car, measuring it, and then jumping in front of it, doesn't that demonstrate a lot of volitional control?
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that demonstrates disregard for his own safety, which is consistent with intoxication. It demonstrates basically just erratic and belligerent behavior, which I would point this court to the case State versus Kruger, which is out of Division III. I think that case is quite a lot like this one in terms of basically circumstantial evidence and what the court determined. There was substantial evidence of both his intoxication and that the intoxication impacted his mental state, because in that case, he shows up at a woman's house. He's acting obnoxiously. He's acting rude. The cops show up. He tries to break a bottle over one of the officer's heads. He headbutts another officer. And throughout that entire encounter, he's acting basically belligerent and obnoxious. And that's really similar to what we have here. From the beginning of this incident, Mr. Irvin is acting like a crazy person, completely erratic and belligerent. And, of course, the state places a lot of emphasis on Mr. Irvin's specific malice towards Deputy Hancock, which was elicited at the 3-5 hearing and in the 404B evidence. But he's acting belligerent before Deputy Hancock shows up.
But even if there's similarities in conduct, wasn't there in Ruger and was it Tavokian, more evidence of consumption of alcohol and evidence of actual intoxication?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with you that there are a lot of the cases that are cited by both myself and the state. There's direct evidence of basically how many drinks the defendant has had or how much drugs he's ingested. But I think the progression of the case law demonstrates that courts are realizing that circumstantial evidence can establish intoxication. And I think that's because the recognition that the defendant doesn't have to testify, and basically requiring there to be direct evidence, and especially in this case that Mr. Irvin, had 3 beers and so many shots of whiskey and so on, basically requires him to testify.
There wasn't testimony that his eyes were bloodshot, that his breath smelled, that he slurred his speech, that he staggered. I mean, by all accounts, he's very physically active, very physically aggressive. He's controlling when he's going after the vehicles. He's certainly recognizes the deputies and who he's dealing with.
I agree that we don't have the testimony about the bloodshot, watery eyes, but we have several other indications of intoxication, and the case law recognizes that lay people can recognize intoxication, and that's what we have here. We have the 911 caller thinking this guy looks pretty intoxicated. We have Deputy Hancock saying that he was very intoxicated. Of course, that comes out at the 3-5 hearing, which is why I've also made the ineffective assistance claim.
Do we distinguish between conduct that makes you appear to act a certain way as opposed to condition? I mean, it seems to me that the breath and the bloodshot eyes go to the physical condition that exhibits it as opposed to conduct, which may be consistent with either intoxication or some other behavior.
Right, which is why we have both. It's basically the two prongs, that there has to be evidence of intoxication and also its impact on the mental state. And I think in this case, the third, we actually have probably more evidence of its impact on his mental state, given his belligerent behavior, but that there's no reason why circumstantial evidence can't also support a person's intoxication, basically under the second requirement for the voluntary intoxication instruction. And that was the Walters court recognized that. And of course, they were looking at specifically the third prong, because in that case, he had bloodshot, watery eyes, and sort of telltale signs of being intoxicated. But the principle in that case was circumstantial evidence can be enough. And we also have direct evidence in this case, given his staggering and the crazed ranting we can hear on the police recording. So I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Nami Kim, and I represent the state of Washington today. The trial court properly concluded here that the voluntary intoxication instruction was not warranted. The two factors at issue here are whether or not there was substantial evidence of drinking or drug use and evidence that it affected his ability to form that requisite mental state of intent. At most, there was, even in the light most favorable to Mr. Irvin, there was at best a scintilla of evidence that this man had been drinking. And there was even less, and I would argue almost no evidence, that any of Mr. Irvin's behavior that night was anything but goal-directed. All the evidence showed that he was absolutely able to form the requisite intent for these crimes. I would respectfully disagree with the characterization of the facts in the record. I want to emphasize that some of the facts brought up by Mr. Irvin in his briefing cannot be considered by this court as evidence that the trial court would take into account when making the decision about whether or not to allow this instruction. That 911 tape was never played for either the court or the jury. Apparently, there was a 911 tape where the caller said, and we don't know because it's not in the record, that there may be a drunk guy running around. The only evidence that we have of any alcohol during this entire trial was Deputy Hancock saying that he saw Mr. Irvin pick up a beer can off the ground, not on his person. He picked it up off the ground and threw it at somebody, which indicates that it wasn't even his. He wasn't drinking from it.
Didn't he also make a reference that when he arrived, the two men appeared intoxicated?
That was only during the pretrial hearing. That was never, ever brought out during the trial itself. And when we're deciding whether or not the intoxication instruction is appropriate, the evidence that can be considered is what was presented at trial. That was never actually in the record. The jury never heard anything about that. Deputy Hancock didn't testify about that.
But doesn't that lead us right into the ineffective assistance argument?
I definitely reference that if I can move on to that. I don't believe trial counsel here was faced with a very difficult position. She had many obstacles against her with respect to why she wouldn't have brought that out. By the time trial started, she knew that she had an unpopular defense. I think voir dire was very clear that this jury was at the very least confused, very reluctant at the idea of a voluntary intoxication idea. They felt it was, they kept mistaking it for a complete defense. They didn't like that. So that's what she was stuck with. She was also stuck with a client who had pretty much undercut her ability at trial to proceed with a voluntary intoxication argument. He testified. He was the only person who testified as to what he may have ingested. And even then, we don't know when during the day. But he said very clearly, oh, no, my memory's pretty good. I remember this. I was basically clear-minded here. He also testified extensively to the fact that he didn't like Deputy Hancock. Whether or not the 404B, those specific incidents of his entanglements with Deputy Hancock and other deputies came in, he was very open about his bias. They did not have a good relationship. Counsel was also faced with the fact that if she chose to do an aggressive cross of Deputy Hancock and elicit, hey, he appeared intoxicated to you, where would that have really gotten her? At the most, we would have gotten his impression, well, they both appeared intoxicated to me. But remember, there are two prongs here, not just the fact of intoxication, but critically whether or not this affects somebody's ability to form the requisite mental mens rea. And here, even if she had asked that, either she or the state definitely would have followed up and said, you said he appeared intoxicated. Do you believe that that was the cause or the reason behind his actions towards you? Do you believe that it interfered with his ability basically to form intent? Not the state wouldn't have said it in those many words, but essentially that would have been the follow-up. Deputy Hancock would have said no, because this man has a history with him. This man has a history of hating him. They have a history such that the deputy is worried about the safety of his own family on Vashon Island. So what counsel would have gotten, and this was a very strategic decision on her part, is at the most maybe you could get his opinion based on what we don't know. There was never anything in the record about whether this was just his assumption. There clearly were no facts stated either at pretrial or trial of physical objective signs of intoxication. He was not staggering. He was not red-eyed. He was not. He had no odor. Everything, in fact, supported that he was not influenced, such as ability to form the mental intent here was compromised. But counsel wouldn't have gotten anywhere with that questioning. It would have, in fact, been much more harmful. She would have harmed her client much more by asking those questions, because it definitely would have opened the door, even without a reconsideration of the 404B ruling, to legitimate questions about the bias that Mr. Irvin had against Deputy Hancock. And the court had already indicated that she was willing to reconsider her 404B ruling about those specific incidents that happened before that did not involve alcohol, in which she attacked Deputy Hancock and other deputies. The court had already stated that she was willing to reconsider that. She asked for briefing on it, because once the voluntary intoxication argument became clear post-voir dire, is when the state brought it up, it looks like we're going for involuntary intoxication here. Would the court consider reconsidering the 404B ruling? The court was open to that. So had counsel actually gone in that direction, decided I'm going to aggressively cross to Deputy Hancock, it would have potentially opened the door to something that would have destroyed any argument that she would have had. It was better in her case to simply just be vague, as she did, and it was better to be vague, and essentially what she did during opening and closing was a better strategic decision. She wanted to infer maybe perhaps there was mental illness here, not just alcohol, because voluntary intoxication was not a popular defense. Mental illness is a much more sympathetic defense, because it's not voluntary. I mean, the wording she chose was very careful. If you look at her opening and closing, she just says he wasn't in his right faculties. She made one reference in closing to his altered state. This was arguably a legitimate trial strategy, the state would submit. Another thing I want to point out, that I'm talking about Deputy Hancock here, the other issue that Mr. Irvin has with his attorney is that she should have called Mr. Fuller, Andy Fuller. Any expectation that Mr. Fuller's testimony would have been useful is based on pure speculation. There is nothing in the record to support that Mr. Fuller had anything regarding Mr. Irvin's state. There was no statement ever taken by Mr. Fuller. We don't know what he would have said. We don't even know whether or not Mr. Irvin was with Mr. Fuller throughout the day. This incident happened at 9:15 at night. What we know from the pretrial hearing is that, and Mr. Irvin was the only one who had this knowledge, and he probably, in a good decision of his counsel, chose not to testify, but all we know is that at some point he said earlier that day he had done meth. We don't know when. He said that he'd been drinking at some point and probably smoking marijuana throughout the day. The only point he mentioned, Mr. Fuller, in conjunction with all this is, you know, we were doing graffiti together at some point. We don't know whether Mr. Fuller was even there to have observed all of this copious ingestion of drugs and alcohol. The record is silent on that. So to say, well, she should have called Fuller, we don't know what he would have said. We also don't know what counsel knew, whether or not counsel had ever contacted Fuller and perhaps discovered all of this on her own, that his testimony actually wasn't going to be very helpful. We don't know if she spoke to him. There's nothing in the record about that. And finally, I just want to point out that Mr. Fuller's absence was not, there's nothing in the record to say that it was a result of counsel's failure. She was pretty clear from the beginning. I think even before trial started, it was at pretrial, she told the court, I don't think my efforts to secure him are going to be successful or fruitful. And that was at 1 RP 81. The state, even with the help of two deputies who were assigned to Vashon, who said, oh, we're pretty sure we can get him here, even they couldn't get him there. So this was not an issue where she just had never thought about him, was ignoring him. It occurred to her, obviously, that he may be a witness of the state's, but it wasn't because of her complete inaction that he was not there. The bottom line here, Your Honors, is that there was not substantial evidence of either the second or the third prong. As the court pointed out, contrasting with what counsel's argument is, I think that the third prong here is the weakest of all. Mr. Irvin timed his jumps. He purposely ran from Deputy Hancock to avoid arrest. And this is a factor that both State v. Gabreshack and State v. Walters pointed out is indicative of somebody's ability to form intent. He announced his intention to spit. He's very physically agile, and he kicked several blows. And my last statement before asking this court to affirm is he was able to turn it off when he needed to, and he did. It was a decision on his part. We ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Just to respond to a few of the state's points. First, the 911 caller testifies at trial to what he said on the 911 call and what he reported to police, and so that's in the record. It's also in Deputy Anderson's police report, which is introduced during his cross-examination, that he received a 911 dispatch that there was an intoxicated man in the street. So that's in the record. In terms of the jury being confused during voir dire, I agree the jury seemed confused. And basically, the voluntary intoxication instruction clarifies that, and it demonstrates why the instruction was so critical in this case, because it explains that basically you're no less culpable for the crime, but the jury then can consider the intoxication evidence in determining whether the person acted with intent. And so that explains to the jury, guides them in how to use this intoxication evidence in determining whether Mr. Irvin acted with intent. And certainly the jury was concerned, well, we don't want to basically determine somebody's not at fault or, criminally liable because they're intoxicated. And so that's why Washington courts recognize that the instruction is so critical, and that's in Rice and Kruger and Walters and all these cases that have found prejudice or ineffective assistance for failing to request the instruction. In terms of the 404B evidence, the court made the determination to exclude the ER 404B evidence when she knew that voluntary intoxication was going to be the defense. And she excluded, basically, Mr. Irvin's specific malice towards Deputy Hancock with the knowledge that the defense was pursuing a voluntary intoxication instruction. And so I don't think that the state's representation that would have come out had Deputy Hancock been cross-examined about Irvin's intoxication. I don't think that would have opened the door for all that specific 404B evidence. And finally, in terms of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, It seems to me that the state is sort of arguing that defense counsel kind of self-sabotaged the voluntary intoxication instruction. And based on the fact that she requested the instruction and sought that defense and made opening and closing argument consistent with that defense, then we think we can presume that defense counsel wanted that instruction and not that she somehow sort of avoided eliciting the evidence to try to not actually get the instruction. That instruction was essential to Mr. Irvin's defense. It was basically his sole defense that he was acting without intent that day because of his intoxication. And so we'd ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.